Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Shot Wake Up. This is your weekly wildfire update. Hope everybody's doing good out there. Early August, pushing through the first week here. Lots going on. Alaska is dragging on. Lots of wildfire activity up there. Two major fires, one outside of Fairbanks, one outside of Anderson, Alaska, pushing large pyrocumulus columns day after day. They have fire weather and red flags today. And fire operators up there are saying that it's going to be a very big weekend. Somewhat of a shock to me. I knew that they had continued activity, and I've been talking about that on the podcasts and the articles on the Substack, the hotshotwakeup.substack.com, that the Southwest has been having these lightning fires kind of lingering on as we push deeper into monsoon season. But last night, they moved to a preparedness level 4 down in the Southwest. And that was kind of a shock to me because this time of year, it is usually starting to wind down. They had a slow start, but they have pushed their preparedness level to a level 4, which, if you don't know, 5 is the highest. I was kind of shocked to see that. And now we wait to see if nationally we go to a PL4 with these larger fires now starting up in Washington. We have this sourdough fire in the Cascades that ripped yesterday. Montana and Idaho kind of got a little bit of cooler, wetter weather, but by no means did it put all of the fires out up there. The Great Basin is seeing fires, lightning-caused fires mostly, with some weather pushing through there, but they are also seeing increased activity as well. And then down in Texas, they've had multiple days of red flag warnings, fire weather watches. They are seeing a little bust of wildfires down there as well and have been extremely busy. We'll cover all the details of that here in just the second segment. I'm going to start with kind of a feel-good story. It was written a little while ago, but I think with Alaska burning and the conversations of wages and the difficulty of raising a family while being a wildland firefighter, this kind of falls right in there. And it's a story by Mike McMillan talking about what it was like being a smoke jumper up in Alaska, meeting his wife, and then becoming a father, and the difficulties of that, the joys of that. And it gives a good perspective on what it is like today. And this was written maybe a few years ago, but it's a great story nonetheless, and I don't think a lot of people have heard it. And it kind of gives a good description of the smoke jumper life as you're trying to raise a family. This was out of the publication Fatherly, entitled What It's Like to Parachute into Wildfires While Raising a Family. When a wildfire breaks out in a remote backcountry, likely due to a lightning strike, but sometimes not, smoke jumpers are called. These elite firefighters, part of the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, parachute into remote areas to contain the often unpredictable and deadly blazes. It's an extreme and extremely dangerous profession, one that requires tremendous dedication and sacrifice, often not for much pay. Most make around $45,000 a year. The work is especially demanding if you're a family man. Mike McMillan, a husband and father of two, spent 17 years as a smoke jumper in remote Alaska. We spoke to Mike about his time fighting fires and how after he became a husband and father, it became hard to justify his career. Now, this kind of hits home with my family because my brother had his daughter and had to make that decision of, can I continue to be a smoke jumper and make $45,000 a year and raise a family? And ultimately, he left smoke jumping after a long career of hotshotting and decided to go a different route simply because it's very difficult to do that sort of thing. Mike says, in 1988, when I was in college, I joined a short-season firefighting crew called a Type 2 crew. After that, I went to a hotshot crew. Those are 20-person crews that respond to wildfires and do a lot of hiking. Yeah, absolutely. There's one year where we started GPSing everywhere we walked, and by the second day in August, we had hiked 500 miles. And that's not even with the GPS on all the time. That's when we remembered to turn it on. So not even halfway through the fire season, we had already put on 500 miles walking around the desert and the forests of the United States. So yes, hotshots do an insane amount of hiking. He was a hotshot for about 7 seasons, it says. Then he finished college, where I did journalism at Cal Poly. After that, I had to make some decisions. Did I want to become a journalist, or do I want to continue fighting fires? Smoke jumping is a type of wildfire fighting where you are delivered by parachute to wildfires, usually in remote areas. It was a lot more inspiring for me to become a smoke jumper. I was qualified. There were guys on my hotshot crew that had gone and done that in Alaska. And you'll see that a lot. People from hotshot crews will go jump. They'll come back for a supervisor position. Then they'll go jump again. And there's actually kind of this, like, really good revolving door when it comes to hotshot crews and smoke jumping. It's a good relationship. And it's one that you would hope continues because you're getting good people from both sides. It says, I liked Alaska. I liked the idea of working there. All told, I did it for 17 years in Alaska, as well as the lower 48. When fire season was upon us and the interior of Alaska was heating up, lightning would strike everywhere. And that's currently what's happening in Alaska. They had a massive amount of lightning come through, and now they have fires everywhere. We would go to work at 7:30 in the morning. Sometimes we'd show up to work, and there would be an order for smoke jumpers to go out right away. And that's what we do as soon as we got there. Smoke jumpers don't like to say, yeah, I was scared shitless. But I can say that when I jumped out of a plane, there were times when I looked down and I didn't even know where I was going to land. Yeah, I was scared shitless. And I've actually had beers and drinks with a lot of smoke jumpers who say the same thing. They're these alpha type one mentalities, these jack dudes and gals who are running around, but you know, you get a cocktail or two in them and they're like, yeah, dude, sometimes it's like, oh God, what am I going to do right now? I don't know where I'm going to land. So yeah, they do feel that way, even though they have that rough exterior. We'd wait for fires to happen. Once the siren went off, we'd run and suit up in the ready room and suit up Kevlar jumpsuits and grab all of our gear and head to the airplane as quick as we can. Within minutes, we'd get briefed en route as to what the fire was doing, and then we'd jump in and take care of it, get picked up by helicopters and taken back to our base or to a highway, and then come back to base and do it again. You can even jump 2 fires in a day if you get out of the station when there's a lot of lightning. Sometimes I would circle like a buzzard until I found something. I've been too close to fire. I have always planned my escape, but you can't plan based on what you think the wind is going to do. I've been in situations where you're depending on the weather forecast or predicted weather. That's where you have to be very careful because the wind can switch 180 degrees and you don't have anyone to blame when it does. I was a smoke jumper when I met my wife, Molly. Looking back, I think I intentionally chose the wrong girlfriends so they'd break up with me and I could keep smoke jumping. Now, that point can't be more true. Hotshots do it all the time. Smoke jumpers do it all the time. I've written numerous articles on the Substack about it where firefighters, both gals and guys, get in relationships that they detonate right before the season starts so they don't have to worry about being in a relationship during the season. And it happens to everybody. They're like the most popular articles that I write because it happens so often. And basically, the season ends, you find yourself a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and you have a lot of fun during the off season. You travel around, you go to beaches, you go skiing, you have a great time, and then you slowly start to realize, like, oh my gosh, fire season's coming. This is a lot to handle. All of my mental focus is on the fire season, and this is going to be a struggle to have this on my plate when we go through. And then you detonate the relationship, flush it down the toilet and say, I'm done. Get out of here. It's over. I got to go fight fire now. And it usually ends in a fiery crash. And yeah, like Mike McMillan said, sometimes you pick the girlfriends because you know that you're going to break up with them when the season's over. Now, I think it's getting a little bit better. And I tried to get better at it when I was deeper into my career. But my mistake was as I continued dating hotshots who then would detonate the relationship they were in with me. in a classic style on how I used to operate, and I basically was just shooting myself in the foot. But as you can see, it's a trend, and it's a trend that has been going on for a while. Continuing, it says, but when I met the right one, being his wife Molly, she was working at the same place I worked. Molly was a farm girl who graduated from college and decided to come to Alaska to do flight operations. Classic story. I saw her walking by, and 2 years later, we were married in Alaska. I continued jumping for 5 or 6 years after we got married. Having my daughter was a life-changing event. If you're going to have children, you need to be a big part of your kid's life. You need to be there. Well, not only was I not there, but I really wasn't making enough money to support my family for the rest of the year. Classic stuff. Smoke jumping is a seasonal gig, and smoke jumpers make about $50,000 a year. And that's with all of the overtime that you get. That's not like your base wage. And let's be honest, for being gone that much and the level of risk associated with the job, it's not a lot of money. If your goal is to be a provider and be steady, smoke jumping is not the ideal path. You might be helping families, but you're not helping your own family. Again, it's just classic stuff, and why I've been pushing so hard for benefits and raises for these people, because you literally are in poverty trying to raise a family if this is what you do, and it's horrible. And, you know, I think that someone should be able to be a firefighter and raise a family. Like, I don't know why it's taken people who are in charge of these things so long to realize this. Continuing, it says, but when you're surrounded by such fun-loving, work-oriented people as smoke jumpers, it's easy to enjoy life. And that's it. They don't want to leave the job because it's so much fun. And you build such a great community around you when you are fighting fire that it's really difficult to leave that profession. There are always activities planned, and it's its own type of family. Exactly. As the years went on, however, I started becoming less outgoing as my family was growing. I sought out social engagements at parties a lot less. It became less and less important or appealing and fulfilling. It was actually depressing to sit at a bar with your buddies when your wife is trying to cook dinner far away. Pfft, no kidding. That's basically how I evolved as well, is in the later years. In my hotshot career, people would want to go to the bar and hang out, and I'd be sitting in the bar missing my gal, being like, I don't even want to drink. Like, I don't even want to party. And it becomes that dilemma. It says my body started to suffer as well. My hips were not what they once were, and my cartilage was bone on bone. As it did, I would start to look out a window of the jump ship for roads and how we were going to get out of where we were going. I realized that that was not the mindset I used to have and that I should have. I was worried about how far I was going to have to carry 120 pounds on my back and if there were any trails that I could use to do that. When my son Ian was born in 2010, it just became painfully obvious that my family needed me more than my crew did and that I needed my family more than I needed my crew. My son's birthday is in September. It was a good goal for me to always be home by then. But my little girl's is in March. She would have her birthday, and the next day I would have to leave for the season. One of those times I left my wife in the driveway holding Heidi, and my wife was crying. She's a very strong woman. When I saw tears running down her face, I just said to myself, I can't keep doing this. When you come back and realize what you've missed because they've grown so much and developed so much and done so many fun things without you, that starts to sink in. Your family has to get used to you and you to them all over again. Man, ain't that the truth. I had both my hips replaced and I resigned in 2013 with no workers' compensation. I was ready to leave the Federal Firefighting Service, heal up, take care of my family, and that's what I did. I didn't stop firefighting completely, though. Even though I had both my hips replaced because of the work, I was able to pass the PT test, which is the physical requirement to continue fighting fires. Today, I'm a fireline supervisor for the Boise Bureau of Land Management and task force leader. I'm also a public information officer. Both of those jobs pay about $500 a day with no health insurance or benefits or retirement. So that's not ideal either. It'll likely change. I love firefighting, but but I love my family more. I thought I'd share that story because it's just so typical of what we see in the wildfire world even today. People who start out young and they're chomping at the bit to work and do labor and build communities within their crews and have a good time while they're at work, even though you're getting paid peanuts. And then life progresses. You go through the cycle of dating people who then you end up detonating that relationship or you self-destruct the relationship or vice versa for years and years until you find the right one. And then, you know, you get married, you have some kids, and you start to realize, I can't afford to raise my family fighting fire. And it happens till today. It needs to change, and I think we all know that, but it's just amazing to me that it's carried on so long and we haven't been able to move past that. And it's just this cycle of hardworking men and women joining the force, putting everything they have into it, getting busted up, and then realizing, oh, like, can I keep doing this? I got a wife now. I have a kid now. You know, like Mike said in the article, you end up sitting at the bar. You're 500 miles away from your home. And all you're thinking about is your family. And you start thinking, well, I don't want to drink. Why am I here? And or it's the opposite. And you get depressed, so you drink more. And that happens a lot as well. But it's really sad to see that sort of thing happen over and over. But also, it's great that these firefighters, smoke jumpers, hotshots share these stories. And it's why I write about it on the Substack, because it's good to have that out there, to let people know you're not alone. This happens. This is, I don't want to say it's normal, but it kind of is with the way that, you know, the wildfire world is. But I think it's a good insight into that world, especially for the listeners who aren't wildland firefighters. Like, this thing happens all the time. This is the life of wildland firefighters. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who have known and loved wildland firefighters, hotshots, smoke jumpers. And the main question is like, you know, I love them so much. Why do they keep doing it? Why do they keep doing it? Why do they do this to themselves? And the simple answer is because they love it. And again, the podcast on Tuesday on the Substack, if you missed it, it's thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. I talked about, you know, the comparison to, you know, the folks saying, well, they could quit fire and make more money serving at a restaurant, or they could make more money at In-N-Out Burger. And I just went on a little rant on that show being like, of course they could, but they're not going to, and they don't want to, because they're currently jumping out of airplanes into fire or hiking 500 miles with 50 pounds on their back through the wilderness, going on adventures and trying to put out massive blazes. Like, they become addicted to adrenaline. They love the community. They build all these friends, and it is a makeshift family, and that just becomes very, very hard to leave. And what it really comes down to is you need to pay these people more. It's just the way it is. There are people like you and I trying to get by, and yes, they are putting their bodies on the line. They are destroying their hips and their knees and their shoulders and whatever else. And it's just another reminder that we need to push forward these compensation packages and make this more of a livable profession than what it has been in the past, because these people want to help protect homes. They want to help protect nature. They want to help protect our parks and our forests. And it just weighs on them when they have to make these hard decisions. So, great article. Thanks, Mike McMillan, for putting that out there. On that note, thank you to all the Substack subscribers, the monthly subscribers. Everything I do, I can't do it without you. If you enjoy what you hear here or reading the articles or all the updates on the social media, the donations, the giveaways, you can participate in that by going to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on that subscribe button, and you help support everything that I do here at The Hotshot Wake Up. Once again, thank you to everybody who partakes in that. You're a small group, but I'm able to take time out on a Saturday morning to get this out there and provide this wildfire content for everybody. So thank you.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
So it's been quite busy the last week in the United States when it comes to wildfire. Of course, up in Canada, they're still busy. The Yukon went to a PL4 up there. British Columbia is still burning. As I said at the top of the show, in the United States, the Southwest went to a preparedness level 4, which caught me off guard. I didn't think that they'd see over a PL3 as the season went on here, but they're still getting fire and a lot of IAs, and that's what it is. They have a lot of IAs happening, and they're short of resources. They need more resources. As of right now, the nation stands at a preparedness level 3. Again, I'm a little shocked that that hasn't bumped up. It probably will here in the next couple days, but that's where we currently sit. In the last 24 hours, there were 107 new fires. 7 of those were new large fires. There's 29 uncontained large fires currently in the nation, and 17 teams are committed on wildfires. Currently in the United States, there's 53 fires being managed under a strategy other than full suppression, meaning that they are using it for resource benefit and what we call it in the industry, they're just letting it do its thing. That number has been growing steadily over the last couple weeks. The Northern Rockies area has been incredibly busy. They're at a PL3. Again, that kind of shocked me, but with the cooler weather and a little bit of precipitation that came through, maybe that's why they kept it there. But out of that weather system, they got even more fires because there was a bunch of lightning that came. They had 7 new fires, 2 of those large incidents, 11 uncontained large fires in the Northern Rockies, and 4 teams are up there as well. The Big Knife Fire, that's on the Flathead Agency, it's Bureau of Indian Affairs Management. They have Northern Rockies Team 3 up there, and they've also bundled up the Nearanda fire and the Mill Pocket fires into what they are calling just kind of like a makeshift complex up there. The Big Knife is pushing 4,500 acres. It's still burning. It's grown almost 2,000 acres in the last 24 hours. They have 110 people there, and it's already cost $2.5 million. If you add the other fires in that complex that are being managed by Northern Rockies Team 3, the Nearanda fire, which is very large, it's 15,000 acres. That thing romped. 115 people, 1.7 million. And the Mill Pocket fire pushing 2,200 acres at a cool $1 million on that cost. All of those fires up in Montana. The other two, besides the Big Knife, are outside of Elmo. And if you keep moving around the state, you find the Gravel Pit Fire. That's up by Libby, Montana. That's cost $1.5 million at just 300 acres. 109 people on that. And then the Colt Fire, which has been going for a while now. They have a pretty good handle on it from what I understand. Northern Rockies Team 1, which transitioned to a Critical Incident Management Team, Northern Rockies Team 5. Just outside of Sealy Lake, Montana, this is a timber fire. It's been burning. They had a lot of activity, 7,200 acres and a cost of $16 million. That's basically where they put a lot of their personnel up in Montana when it comes to these fires. There's 600 people on it, a bunch of hotshot crews, engines, aviation, trying to slow that thing down. Now, if you go back a couple weeks, we were talking about the Colt Fire weeks ago. On the Substack podcast, where they basically had this thing caught numerous times, and there was some political bullshit that went on. That's just the easiest way to describe it. And it squeaked out, and it got out, and it turned into kind of this monster, which we now know as the Colt Fire. And I saw pictures where they had retardant around the whole thing, no smokes on the fire, and then the next day it romped, you know, 1,000 acres or whatever it was. So that's been an interesting one to follow. It has ended up costing $16 million, as I said. And it just continues to go. And then Montana just has a ridiculous amount of fires. A lot on the Flathead National Forest. There's a bunch on the Bitterroot. The Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest still has some fires burning. The Kootenai, which I love saying that. There's the East Fork Fire out of Trago, Montana. That ripped nearly 1,000 acres, cost $1.2 million. And then these fires that are spattered around Idaho as well. This Ridge Creek fire on the Idaho Panhandle, that romped. It says 300 acres. Wouldn't be surprised if it's a little bigger than that. But again, cost you $1.5 million. Very busy in the Northern Rockies. If you look at the Northwest area, they're at a PL3. 13 new fires. They have 6 uncontained large fires. The one of note on that one is the sourdough in the North Cascades. They brought in a Type 2 team. It's Northwest Team 10. They're moving to that area. Again, burning in the Northern Cascades, ripping. Huge pyrocumulus columns pushing yesterday. Tons of activity. Jumped a bunch of creeks. Major uphill runs. And will ultimately probably take up a lot of resources here in the next couple days. Currently only 267 people on it. Costing around $1 million, but I think those numbers will change very quickly. Then the fires that have been kind of lingering up there, the Bedrock fire, the Flat fire, both in Oregon. Bedrock still only 5% contained at 12,200 acres and a cost of $14.5 million. The Flat fire in Oregon, 32,000 acres. They have 1,000 people on that fire. And a cost of $37 million. So Oregon is spending those fire budgets on these larger fires right now. The Eagle Bluff fire in Washington, that's the one that burned into Canada. Some pretty significant activity. They've been doing some firing operations off the rivers up there to kind of corral this thing in. That sits at around 16,500 acres, 600 people on it, and a cost of $6 million. As I was saying, the Southwest area moved to a PL4, so they are still very active pushing into monsoon season after a slow start this year. They had 9 new fires, 2 of those becoming large incidents, 6 uncontained large fires, and there's a Type 2 team down there managing some of these incidents, that being the Cottonwood Ridge fire. It's a smaller fire at 345 acres, but they have 300 people on it and a cost of $5.4 million. That fire is on the Fort Apache Agency. It's Bureau of Indian Affairs Management. It's being managed by Southwest Team 5, but they are transferring command back to a local unit. There's this Diamond fire on the Tonto National Forest, the Spoon fire, which is also on the Fort Apache Agency, this Grapevine fire. They received some precipitation on the Grapevine, but they are still trying to get that fully contained on the Prescott National Forest. And then just a spattering of a bunch of smaller lightning fires that have been taking place. And I'll rip through a couple of these. There's the Pryor fire on the Gila, 4,100 acres. The Pasture fire on the Gila, 6,800 acres. There's the Dark fire on the Gila, 1,800 acres. The Davis fire on the Gila National Forest, 6,100 acres. So there's these fires that have kind of just materialized with the lightning coming through. They had some strong winds, and the Southwest continues to be very, very busy. Arguably the busiest place in the nation, other than the Northern Rockies, and you could make the argument maybe Alaska's busy, but with the amount of fire, it's actually pretty impressive this late into their season, putting up those types of numbers. The Great Basin's at a preparedness level 3, 17 new fires. They have one Type 2 team down there managing this Elkhorn fire on the Payette National Forest, Great Basin Team 2. And then they have a complex incident management team that is managing this Hayden fire on the Sam and Chalice National Forest. Both of these are very large fires. The Elkhorn started out kind of a smaller fire. They threw some people at it, and then a couple days ago, it just blew up. It romped, jumped the Salmon River, and currently is sitting at over 24,000 acres. That's cost $2.7 million at this point in time. The Hayden fire has scooped up a bunch of resources. Looks like the type of fire where people will be doing multiple roles on it. They're at 25,000 acres as well, and a cost of $14.8 million. Again, it'll be interesting to see if Nevada has a season, if their desert season materializes into anything. There's plenty of fuel on the ground, but they've seen a lot of moisture in the last, you know, last while. And so that still needs to dry out. But I think when it does, it might be off to the races in places like Nevada. If you move to Alaska, they're at a PL3. Like we said, they're expecting a huge weekend and a lot of activity pushing through their area coming up in the next couple days. They had 6 new fires, 1 large fire. 2 teams are up there. The big one being the Anderson Complex, burning 11,000 acres. Only 270 people on it, costing $2.7 million. Outside of Fairbanks, they had the Lost Horse Creek fire. That thing is putting in a lot of work. Huge columns, evacuations in effect. Alaska Green Team is managing that one. And then there's just a laundry list of smaller fires happening in Alaska as well. The Pogo Mine fire, 17,000 acres. The McCoy Creek fire, 8,000 acres. And just a long, long list of other fires that are burning in between that 700 to 12,000 acre range. And in classic Alaska fashion, a lot of these fires only cost about $10,000, even though they're 12,000 acres, because they're unstaffed. It's just so vast and so large that they don't even staff these fires and they burn freely up there, which is something that happens up in Canada as well. And a lot of people don't fully realize is these land masses are so huge that you just leave a lot of these things unstaffed and let them burn. The Rocky Mountain area, Colorado, they actually have red flags today. So it should be interesting to see where that takes us. There's this low-lying fire that I don't want to say it's out, but there's a lot of resources hanging out there and it's not doing much. It's 1,776 acres. Very patriotic number there. And it's cost $4.9 million at this point. That's out of Grand Mesa, Colorado. Rocky Mountain Team 1 is managing that fire. When this fire first started, it was running and tremendous amount of activity. Insane footage came out of that. And maybe caught a few people off guard because of the activity that was there. But Colorado has had a bunch of IAs. There's also this dry lake fire on the San Juan National Forest outside of Bayfield, Colorado. That ran 300 acres, 135 people on that one. And again, I think we need to watch Colorado moving deeper into the weekend. If you move to California, they had the York fire. That fire is basically out. The Bonnie fire, that fire is basically out. The York ran almost 100,000 acres, costing $3.5 million. The Bonnie fire, 2,300 acres at $21 million for the cost of that. And a couple other smaller fires in that area. And then if you move down to Texas, they had 12 new fires, 1 new large incident, 2 uncontained large fires. The Laguna Larga fire, a couple cool videos came out of that with some dozer operators sending me some footage that I posted of them working that fire, 775 acres. The Black Lagoon fire, 430 acres. That's actually in Louisiana. And a couple other fires down in Texas as well. And with red flags and fire weather pushing into the area this weekend, I expect to see significant fire activity in Texas. I know that was a lot, but there's a lot going on. And the United States is very busy. It's going to continue to be busy, especially with the forecast that we're seeing. Keep an eye up in the Pacific Northwest, especially the sourdough fire. This thing is romping. And we'll see if in the next couple days we push to a PL4 nationally and where all these resources are going to be allocated. On a side note, a lot of the jumpers that have been in Canada, they're getting pulled back and brought up into Alaska because of the need there. And we're at a point now where fire managers are saying to themselves, hey, we need to start thinking about bringing some of our folks home. And that's even with the Yukon and British Columbia still burning actively. But it's good to have them home, especially after that story that we covered in the first segment of how difficult it is if you are a family, man or woman, and you're away from home, especially in a different country. For a lot of these folks this year, they've been spending most of their fire season in a different country. They are now hopefully able to go home and see their families for a little bit before they get shotgunned out and start suppressing all of these other fires that have taken off in the last week. Once again, thanks to all the Substack subscribers. If you want to partake in that, it's greatly appreciated. It's the only way that I'm able to do what I do. I'm ad-free, I'm sponsorship-free, and fully supported by the community. If you want to participate in that, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com and click on that subscribe button.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
The last thing I wanted to cover today is a little bit of California news. Of course, dealing with PG&E, the power company there. A few months ago, we talked on the Substack how they reduced the amount of lines, power lines, that they said they were going to bury across the state, which was promised in these deals that they made with the state when it came to bankruptcy and all this other stuff. And then they came out and said, well, we're only going to bury less than half the amount of power lines that we said we were going to, and the reason being is it's cost too much money and it's bad for our shareholders to be spending all this money burying power lines. Then the Wall Street Journal put out an article saying that they are scrapping their tree trimming program, which was once seen as key to fire prevention, which I couldn't believe it when I read it, that they're stopping this program. This is from Catherine Blunt out of the Wall Street Journal, saying the California utility spent more than $2 billion on an effort it says was ineffective and are now focusing on power line settings. In my opinion, a very interesting turn of events. The fact that they're saying they spent $2.5 billion on tree trimming, that blows my mind. And I knew people who worked for the utility company that were in fire and then they got these tree trimming jobs and they were making a tremendous amount of money. So maybe that's part of the reason they're cutting this program, is just because they were bleeding out money. But usually that's the case when it comes to these publicly traded companies, power companies that say they're going to do something and then they don't. And then they say, well, you need the power, what about it, so on and so forth. And then they cause fires and there's these lawsuits that take place. And then rates go up even more. Oregon is dealing with this right now as well. Oregon power companies are being sued a tremendous amount, especially the last couple months. And it's kind of a cookie cutter classic situation that has been happening with PG&E that we're seeing now up in Oregon. And then, of course, we talk about it at length on the podcast and on the Substack with all these insurance companies pulling out of these areas now, being like, well, it's too dangerous because of wildfire. But then the other industry, the power industry, is like, well, we're going to stop trimming trees around power lines. It's a mess. It's a mess. We've been predicting it for years, and it's unfolding exactly how we said it was going to happen. And, you know, I shouldn't be shocked to see it, I guess, because 2 years ago I said this is exactly what's going to happen. The article says the California utility company PG&E spent about $2.5 billion on a years-long effort aimed at reducing wildfire risk by cutting or clearing more than a million trees growing alongside power lines. It now says that work was largely ineffective and is eliminating the program, according to an internal analysis review by the Wall Street Journal. Now, before we continue on, duh, okay, that's what I have to say, because, again, we covered this. They were contracting people out to cut these trees. Then those contractors were subcontracting, and then those subcontractors would subcontract again and get low-skilled labor, mostly migrant labor that they could pay cash and then skim off the top. And then people would just top these trees, leave the rest of the tree, which would die and then fall into the power line. Or there was a lot of residents saying that they would cut the trees and leave them, and they would just be trees scattered all around, which are now dead fuel that is going to create more of a wildfire risk. And then there were other residents saying, we've had scheduled for these trees to come down for months and months and months, and no one ever showed up. But you look into the PG&E system, and they're like, no, it says that they've already been cut down. So was there a lot of fraud even in this work? Probably. There's probably a lot of people saying they did the work, collected the money, and no one checked on it. No one double-checked anybody's work. And ultimately, they ended up scrapping this program. California, I got to say, you have a mess out there. I know a lot of people tell you that, and you love your state, and it is a nice state. You have a very beautiful state. But, man, you got a lot of stuff going on out there, especially when it comes to wildfire, where, you know, everyone out there is concerned that wildfire seasons are getting so bad. But when you look at the work being put in and these billions of dollars that Newsom allocated towards wildfire prevention and none of it's been spent, and then all the environmental groups sue everybody and say you can't do these projects because there was a hummingbird up there that I saw, and you just don't get anything done. The article says the strategy shift marks a calculated risk by the utility that new power line settings will be more effective than tree trimming programs that was put in place after a series of devastating fires. The program, which is called the Enhanced Vegetation Management Program, was meant to supplement routine tree trimming work required by regulators. The pivot was subject to considered debate among the company's board of directors, according to people familiar with the matter, and has invited scrutiny from California regulators. Well, yeah, they said they were going to bury power lines. They didn't. They said they were going to cut trees around the power lines. They didn't. And what it comes down to is they're just going to start shutting the power off more. When it comes to power line settings, put that in quotes, that just means they're going to shut your power off more. Continuing, the California utility giant says the program, which involved creating wide spaces between live wires and potentially hazardous trees, resulted in a 13% reduction in ignitions during periods when fire risk is at its highest. Measured across a full year, the work resulted in a 7% reduction in ignitions, the company says. Instead, the company will rely more heavily on new power line settings in areas at high risk of fire. The lines will be shut off within a tenth of a second when branches or other objects touch them, reducing risk of sparks. So again, instead of going out and cutting trees down, leaving them the ability to leave the power on, they're just going to let the trees hit the power lines and then shut your power off. That's their plan. That's their plan. Oh, God. Industry officials say customers may experience more power outages in the coming years if the company's scaled back approach to tree trimming results in more branches hitting wires. They're shutting your power off, people. I mean, come on. The company said it would assess outage-prone circuits and address issues with targeted tree clearing and other safeguards. PG&E says the new approach will be both safer and less expensive. Okay, so shareholder concerns there, as it works to permanently reduce wildfire risk, trying to bury more than 10,000 miles of power line in the coming years, an ambitious plan expected to cost at least $20 billion. Now, we've already talked about this. They scrapped half of that because they said it cost too much. It says the company is challenged in its ability to raise capital following a complex bankruptcy restructuring and has been working to cut costs in order to fund the work. Yeah. The company expects to reduce tree-related spending by about $1 billion between 2023 and 2026 as a result of discontinuing this program, and to a lesser extent, other plans to cut costs, and that includes not burying as many lines as they said they were going to. The company plans to increase its overall wildfire mitigation spending in the coming years as it tries to bury more lines and take other measures. It says, still, the shift in strategy represents a big bet for PG&E. Through the discontinued program, the company identified roughly 385,000 potentially hazardous trees that have yet to be trimmed or cleared, and it's relying on its new power line settings to prevent ignition if any of them touch the power lines. Again, they've decided we're not going to cut the trees down, we're just going to shut the power off. That's where they have gone with this. Caroline Jacobs, the Department of Energy director, says her office is now evaluating the data underlying PG&E's assertion that its enhanced tree work yielded such a limited risk reduction. So, This is what's happening out in California. It's not really like a major surprise, especially after they put out the report about burying the lines and that costing too much. Now they're saying cutting trees is costing too much. And they've moved to a strategy and a plan that they put new sensors or settings on their power lines where if now one of these trees that they were going to cut down that they are now leaving standing falls on a power line, that they should be able to shut the power off to prevent any sort of ignition. That's the plan. That's what they're saying is going to happen. And ultimately, a lot more people in California are going to see a lot less power and a lot more rolling blackouts throughout the state when it comes to the summer and the fall time. So I guess good luck with that. It sounds like a mess. It sounds like a company reneging on a lot of promises made when the state bailed them out. But again, you know, there's these articles saying that PG&E or people within PG&E donated hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to Newsom's wife's charities. And, you know, you can look into that. We've covered it on the Substack before. But, you know, there's probably some favoritism and probably some deals being made. And there's probably some company heads that think they can get away with stuff because they are in good with the governor out there. You know, it is what it is. It's starting to happen in Oregon as well, as we've covered. And I'll probably be covering a lot more because it's just becoming more and more prevalent. On that note, thanks again to the Substack subscribers. I appreciate it. TheHotShotWakeUp.substack.com. Just click on that subscribe button if you want to support the show or all of the updates on social media, the donations, the giveaways. I'm 100% ad-free, 100% I'm 100% ad-free and sponsorship-free. So if you want to help continue this information and the program that I put out there, please visit thehotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on that subscribe button, and become a member of the community. Thank you very much to everybody who already does that. It's greatly, greatly appreciated. On that note, reach out to someone you haven't talked to in a while, check in on your homies, see how they're doing. Get outside, exercise, get those quality calories. Those are the ones that count. Stretch, hydrate, get some rest because that's what you need to recover. But when you get up, you got to get it done. Let me offer you.